Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Now we're going to get a fascinating insight now into a macho, male-dominated world where reality is so grotesquely distorted from the public perception. Sometimes the truth is far more incredible than fiction. We're going to be chatting to the author of Pink Camouflage and the book One Soldier's Story, From Trauma and Abuse to Resilience and Leadership. Welcome to the show, Gemma Morgan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wow, I'm intrigued to hear all about this then. So when did you join the army?
So I was at Sandhurst in the January of 1996, so a few years ago now. But I'd come straight out of university and was really considering what career I wanted to do. And I'd passed selection and I was in at Camberley at the Royal Military Academy in the January.
Is it in the family? Is that what motivated you, or you just decided I'm going to join the army?
No, there's no military background in the family at all. I think my parents were quite surprised. And also at school, there was no cadet force. There was no military there on careers evening. So it was quite a left field decision, really. But a friend was in, and there were these adverts on the telly that just emphasised this sense of belonging and adventure and this idea of this brotherhood, this family, if you like. Well, this promise that you could just have this career of real meaning and purpose, it really attracted me back then.
And it didn't turn out that way, I'm guessing.
At the start, it felt great. I mean, in training, it's at such a pace, there's such a sense of urgency to everything that you do and discipline that I didn't really notice. I just saw some of the early signs really as just a rite of passage. It was very much... felt like if you signed up, then it was part of the deal, and you just had to suck it up, really. And I think overall, you know, when things were going well, when everything was great, it felt good. It was when you emphasized a point of difference, when you needed help, that the wheels started to squeak and things really started to fall apart.
Yeah, I must admit, I always imagine you to have a massive camaraderie. I mean, you've got each other's life in your hands at the end of the day. So I like to think of it as a big family, but I'm sure you'll tell us different. It's obviously quite male dominated, the army. It shouldn't be. And I'm sure things are changing. But did that not help? Was there a lot of misogyny involved?
Well, when I joined, there was about 10% of female as compared to the men, and now it's about 11%. So it hasn't changed hugely in terms of the numbers of women that are in. I think, you know, it was very much as a woman, you were very much an outlier joining up, and you had to fit into a man's world, not just a man's world, but a hyper masculine ideal, this kind of warrior archetype. And that was fine as long as you conformed, as long as you denied any sense of vulnerability or femininity, then that was fine. But if you did, if you emphasized any kind of point of difference, whether that was from gender or sexuality or, for me, my mental health status, then it started to get unsafe.
But as far as the mental health status was concerned, would they have been the same with a man?
I think so, probably. I mean, back then... It was any form of vulnerability. You were taught very early on that it wasn't safe to share it, that you had to hide it, because you didn't want to emphasize that point of difference. And certainly struggling with a mental health issue back then was something that would be seen as career limiting, and you absolutely wanted to hide. And I agree. I think it was absolutely the same for the men as it was for the women. I think the challenge being a woman with a mental health challenge was illness, really, that was that when you add layer that on top of your gender, it becomes this double point of difference that's really challenging to overcome.
Yeah, because no matter what anybody says, you know, we want to be treated equal, etc. But we are biologically different. We have different bodies and different needs. It's just a fact.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, I'm not... My view is very much that whoever you are, whatever your gender or whatever your race or sexuality, whoever you are, as long as you pass the standard to get in, whether the physical standard, the cognitive standards, whatever those standards are, once you've passed them and you're in, then the environment that you step into does need to be inclusive for everybody. And it certainly needs to be safe for everybody. I think I would describe certainly my experiences, and I know many women, if you look at the Atherton inquiry today, the thousands of women that have given evidence, they would say that actually, you know, very little has changed since my time serving, in that when you join, everybody is expected to conform to this hypermasculine ideal, and it's not safe to show any kind of point of difference.
And when you're saying you have to conform, is this coming from hierarchy, or is this your peers, or is it coming from all of them?
I think it's the whole piece, because the you know, at its best, as you said earlier, the military is this incredible brotherhood, and you do feel this wonderful sense of team where everyone's got your back. But what comes with that is that you kind of elevate your sense of specialness together, and you tread down anybody that's not in the group. So if you don't fit in, or if you show a point of what might be considered weakness or vulnerability that doesn't fit in, then it becomes really unsafe for you, and you're cast out. And I think being cast out, certainly I experienced it from an institutional level. It felt like an institutional betrayal, and also cast out by some colleagues and peers as well. So it's a very fine line that you have to tread, because when you sign up, you give up you give up control, really, of your professional life, your personal life, and you're very much trapped behind the wire. It's, you know, it's not like the civilian world. You give up control. But what comes with that is this promise of this duty of care. And when the institution betrays that and doesn't care for you, or if your colleagues turn on you because you've challenged that hypermasculine ideal, it's traumatizing all in itself.
Yeah, I'm sure. And on top of that, you've got a very dangerous job to do. I mean, I've got here that this all happened long before you were being deployed unarmed and unsupported into the mayhem of a war zone.
Yeah, so the thing, everything was going really well for me. I'd got an award as being the best young officer in the Corps. I had a regular commission, which meant I had a job until I retired. Things were looking really good. And then I was deployed out to Kosovo. I was leading a multinational patrol out to the west of Kosovo in 1998, which was before NATO went out in 99. So I was there to really verify what was going on the ground, which built political will for NATO to go out. And professionally, it was exhilarating. It was a real test of my leadership and how we operated together. It was complex and chaotic. But when I came home, I was traumatized. I really struggled to make sense of what I'd seen, and, you know, the ethnic cleansing, and also what we'd done as much as what we hadn't done out there. I felt very morally challenged, and I needed help. Now, years later, I was diagnosed with severe post-traumatic stress directly as a result of that operational tour. But when I asked for help in the military when I came back, there wasn't really any meaningful help available. And furthermore, they then diagnosed me, or misdiagnosed me, with what they called a moderate depression as a result of my genetics, which really pathologizes the problem as somehow it being your fault and it being you. And then furthermore, sticking your head above the parapet and asking for help with a mental health struggle is one thing in that environment, in that hypermasculine environment, certainly career limiting. But then they shared my medical notes through the chain of command. And I got a call one day from my sergeant basically saying that I was a gossip in the officer, in the sergeant's mess. And that completely undermines your credibility and you feel incredibly unsafe. And it makes it very, very difficult to recover in an environment where really you're incredibly vulnerable and you need help.
Shocking. I would have thought out of all the institutions, the army would be at the top, one of the ones at the top of the list that should be offering counselling. Of course you're going to get PTSD. Of course you're going to see some awful things. I mean, we've really not evolved since the First World War and when they used to call it shell shock.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I don't know whether it's a convenient truth or whether it's negligence, but certainly I can only talk about my treatment and having, since I've written the book Pink Camouflage, so many people have been in contact with me saying, gosh, your story is my story. So, you know, I don't know whether it was systemic, but I was treated for trauma. They asked me to relive the trauma, going through photographs, going through, you know, all of the evidence that I'd had to collate as part of my job. But then they diagnosed me with depression as a result of my genes. So it which essentially means that then you there is no medical discharge. No, you know, I chose to leave off my own accord, very ill. But you lose your career. My husband lost his career to look after me because I was so ill. And there's no help. You literally have your ID cards in and you're done. So if you were to look at my medical notes, one would argue it was a convenient truth and certainly negligent. And I'm not the only one, I'm very sorry to say.
And was it easy for you to leave? Did they make that difficult?
No, it was very easy for me to leave. It got to the point where my husband and I, he was serving as well. We felt that the system turned on us and actually became our aggressor. So even from the point of we were serving in the same corps, I was very unwell. We'd had our first child and, you know, they wouldn't even post you even in any kind of close proximity to each other. So you couldn't have even seen each other at weekends. We were serving in the same corps, you know, it's not that difficult. It felt like that they were actually, they turned on us. And it really felt for both of us like an absolute betrayal, which is something that's very hard to get over because the promise, the duty of care that the military promise you is really a sacrosanct pledge, really. Mm. So it's a tough one to take.
So you were still there when you were pregnant with your first child. How did they treat pregnancy then? Was that an inconvenience for them?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was only a few years earlier that before I joined that you were sacked if you were pregnant. So this was... you know, it was still in the changing culture time. I think the only way I would describe it would be that, you know, you stopped getting invited to things. When I went to confirm my pregnancy at the medical center, and I said to the doctor, look, you know, I don't have a physical job at the minute. I will choose to tell people when I'm ready to tell people because it was very early on in my pregnancy. And when I walked from the medical center back up to my office in that time, which must have been a 15-minute walk, the doctor had already called to tell my CO, my commanding officer, that I was pregnant. And I was called in and asked whether it was a mistake. And because I was up for promotion on the board for major. And you just think, wow. It was very much in the dark ages, and I think it was just another point of difference. You felt you spent your whole time trying to be like the men, and then that's a point in your life where you can't be anymore.
Yeah, of course. It really is an eye-opener. Now, am I correct that you had a first-class international sporting career as well?
Yeah, I did. I was an international athlete for many years, actually. I played in three World Cups and won 85 caps. And that's one of the reasons that the army career appealed so much to me, because physically I was very able. So from a physical demands of the job. I was really capable and didn't find it that tricky.
So you've got this outstanding army service record, first-class international sporting career. By this time, you were married, you had two children. But at one point, I know it says in the book, so I hope you don't mind me bringing it up, but your husband found you by the roadside, delirious and choking. I mean, you were really at the depths of despair at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a really, really difficult time for us as a family. I'd left the military late 2002, beginning of 2003, and my husband had left as well, and there was no support, you know. So I struggled as a young mum, but also carrying the post-traumatic stress disorder, which was untreated. And it wasn't until 2006 where I'd got so ill that I wasn't going out, I wasn't answering the phone, you know, I was struggling to function of any kind of normality, and I was admitted into hospital. And treatment started for the first time, really. And because so many years had gone past, it was quite complex then, because I'd been numbing, I'd been trying to cope with alcohol and anything really to kind of ease the trauma symptoms. And it got so bad that I just needed it to stop. It is the only way I can really describe it. And I my husband found me, and I'm very lucky to be here today. I think if it wasn't for the love and support of my husband and my family, it'd be very likely that I wouldn't be.
Bless you. Well, thank goodness you're okay. How are you doing now?
Yeah, I'm in a really good place. You know, I think I started writing in therapy. So from 2007 onwards, I started writing to make sense of it all, to try and, you know, move forward with my life. I never intended to share it in the book, Pink Camouflage. And then it was when I read the thousands of women's testimonies in the Atherton report, and the stories of sexual harassment and the Red Arrows and so many more, Officer Cadet Olivia Perks and Jaisley Becks. And I just felt really compelled that I'm in a place now where I can share what happened to me, because little has changed. And my hope is that, one, it's a fierce and urgent call for culture change, and defence really need to accept they have a problem and do something meaningful about it. And then secondly, I just hope that it might help someone else who might be in the thick of it to give some kind of hope that you can come through it, you can come out the other side. Different, yeah, but it is possible, and you can build a new life for yourself on the other side. So that's what I hope. I hope there's meaning and purpose in sharing the book, that it might help someone else.
Well, I think there is. I mean, there's definitely an urgent call for change. It's shocking that this is still going on at this day and age. And I think people always say, don't they, even if one person reads the book and it helps them, then it's been worth it.
I hope so. And I've had the most, heart-rending messages from some people, but again, you know, real hope that it's purposeful and that this will help someone else. Yeah.
Well done, you. You're an inspiration. Well, we're selling the book right now on our website, so our listeners can go ahead and buy it by clicking on the bookshop banner. It's called Pink Camouflage, One Soldier's Story from Trauma and Abuse to Resilience and Leadership. And it's by Gemma Morgan, who we're talking to now. Now, I know you're also a leadership coach now and a keynote speaker. How can people find out more about you, Gemma?
Gosh, thank you. Yeah, my career now is helping other people and coaching and consulting to help them build high performing teams and improve their leadership. I also do a lot of speaking. I'm sure you won't be surprised around the impact of performance culture on individuals and how we create cultures where people can thrive. So if you want to have another look, it's gemma-morgan.com, gemma-morgan.com. You can see more there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing part of your story on today's show. It's nice to see you doing so well. Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
Bye-bye for now.